It's time for us to get started this morning. It's good to see each and everyone here. This morning we're going to talk about another movement, what some have called the mega church movement, and it's pretty broad. It's not one distinct doctrine. In fact, doctrine doesn't play into it a whole lot at all, and that's what one of the things that we'll look at is that's part of the problem. But it's just the idea of growth for growth's sake and growth being the primary metric of success or failure. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. And I believe some of the influences that particular movement has and has had on various churches of Christ. I'll go ahead and make mention that I'll be out of town this Wednesday night. Mike and I are heading to Illinois to study with Ken McDaniel and L.A. Stopher and others up there. And so Eric Roth is going to be teaching on Wednesday night. And he's going to be talking about the growth and the history of the Islamic religion. And of all the world religions outside of, you know, basic departures from the Bible, I would say that's probably the fastest growing and maybe it's one of the most disconcerting. And there are some things I think that we need to be aware of and understanding. And we're going to have more opportunities to talk to people who are Muslims. And I know that in Fiji, there's a growing population there. And we had several conversations there this last time that we did not have the first trip that we went. And so it's just it's a growing movement. And so therefore, one that we need to be aware of. Maybe one that doesn't hit as close to home to us personally. But nevertheless, it's something culturally that's grabbing hold in a lot of ways. And so, anyway, Eric's going to be talking about that on Wednesday night. I appreciate him being willing to do that. In speaking of the mega church movement, you know, the first thing that we note is in talking about mega churches, what is a mega church? And it's a term that is used and has even been codified to some degree in census data and so forth. And a mega church is defined as being any church with 2,000 or more members. All right. Now, we would obviously consider that a pretty large congregation. I mean, as far as the congregations that we're familiar with and been a part of, we see 2,000 people, we would be, wow, what's going on here? But is there a problem inherently with having 2,000 members? No. How do we know that for absolutely sure? Yeah, all right. 3,000 is the very first number we're given of any church ever is 3,000 members. I will say this, is the day of Pentecost and the following chapters through Acts chapter 8, is that typical or atypical of the response that we see to New Testament preaching? Atypical, all right? We've got an incredible response to a very incredible event. And so we need to be careful because a lot of the megachurch language is predicated on Acts chapter 2 saying, why aren't we seeing more events like we saw in Acts chapter 2? Well, because we don't have circumstances like we had in Acts chapter 2. You will never, ever hear the first gospel sermon preached again. It'll never happen. All right, so that is a unique moment in history that Peter is getting up and preaching literally the first gospel sermon to this audience. And so that can never happen again. You'll never have that audience hearing these things for the first time. You won't have this shift from an old covenant to the new covenant at that moment in time. So there's just so many things happening that we do not have the same circumstances today. I will say you'll come closer to it as you go to places where the gospel simply has not been preached. There are places in the world where you certainly have something more akin to that, where there's a very enthusiastic response and so forth. Here in America, look, we are preaching things that people have heard in some fashion all their lives. And so we're not preaching to that sort of audience that is hearing things that they've never heard in their lives and being overwhelmed by those things. You know, that is not a typical response, and it is something that is frightening when somebody bases the success or failure on whether it looks like what happened in Acts chapter 2. They somehow don't base it on whether or not it looks like what happens in Acts 14. You know, they don't say, we're not successful unless we're driven out of town and stoned to death. Yeah. Nobody seems to be going in that particular direction. They don't look for success in being thrown into prison. They don't look for success in being run out of town and one after another. They only look for success in one particular pattern where it looks like really what they want it to look like. And so we've got to take the whole spectrum into account and say, okay, there are going to be times where people really grab hold of this, and there's going to be times where people really reject this. And those really rejections happen a lot more often than the receptiveness that we see. All right, so that's out at the front. I think one of the things to recognize. We're going to come back to that a little bit more as we talk about Numbers. One of the biggest problems that I see in the mega churches is what they've done is they have set the Bible to the side, at least to some degree, greater and lesser degrees, depending on which church you're looking at. But they've set the Bible to the side, and they've said, what is it that grows an organization? And is organization growth something that you can find literature on? Tony, have you ever read anything about organization growth? Yeah, it's all over the place. There's a whole section in Books a Million about business growth. And so organization growth is certainly an area in which there's lots of research and literature. It involves a lot of psychology and so forth. And so you go out there and you read this literature and you bring what is essentially corporate literature into the church and say, we need to apply these principles to church growth. One writer said what they've done is they've moved away from evangelism and towards entrepreneurialism. All right. And so basically they've taken a business model approach. Now, I've been approached about this before. I was told by one fella, you know, preachers need to be good salesmen. Now, is there any sense in which you can see, Tony, since you're a salesman, can you see any correlation between being a salesman and preaching the gospel?
In the sales.
Yeah.
Close to sale.
Yeah.
The invitation.
Right.
So very somewhat.
Yeah. So there absolutely is some crossover here, and I don't mean that no principle that is used in any sort of organizational growth or any sort of sales pitch or any of those things that there's no crossover whatsoever. However, there are some very distinct lines between what salespeople and business people are doing, and what the church is laid out in doing in the New Testament and what we ought to be patterning ourselves after. What are some very distinct lines or some very distinct differences between those two approaches? Okay, first of all, yeah, success or failure. I mean, if you are trying to sell a product and nobody is buying it, you stop making the product or at least make it different. All right? And what do you make it different based on? What people want. All right. The mega church movement, Rick Warren would be kind of a prototypical. He, in fact, is the modern day prototype for the mega church movement. All right. So people look to him, purpose driven life, purpose driven church, and 40 days of purpose. We'll talk some more about that. It's very personality driven, incidentally. But they look to him as the pattern for how to grow churches. What he did and what others who he patterned himself after before him did is they literally went into the neighborhoods and surveyed them and asked them what they think church should be like. And they made the church in accordance with what they found in those surveys. Now, don't you suppose that that's going to get a good response? If you ask people what they want and you give it to them, by all means, people are going to show up. What's the problem for us? Did Peter do a neighborhood survey before the day of Pentecost? Yeah, and was it always what people wanted? No, Acts chapter 7 looks a lot different than Acts chapter 2. Stephen, he didn't understand this purpose-driven approach. He didn't understand going into the neighborhoods and figuring out what they wanted. And boy, he was one of these guys that just, you know, got up in their face and made them angry. And if he'd have just asked them what they wanted, he could have given it to them. Tony?
But they're different.
No.
Because in Acts 2.
No. No, their approaches aren't different at all, and I'm not saying they are. The response is, but the response is not based on figuring out what people want and giving it to them. The response, in fact, the response is the same. They're cut to the heart in both places. And then what that means and what they do with that hurt is what changes. All right. And so one brings that hurt to God. What do we need to do? One brings that hurt to, we're going to hurt you. And they stone Stephen to death. And so, so you've got, you know, a completely different picture. What ends up happening is people tell you what they don't want to hear, what they do want to hear. They tell you what they want the church to provide and so forth. We'll talk about that more in just a minute. And so they end up, you end up, very much a business model. We're going to supply the felt needs. This is a buzzword, the felt needs of the people. So what are your felt needs? In other words, what do you feel like you need, and we'll provide that? Andy Stanley, who is another megachurch pastor, says, people are not in a search for truth. They are in a search for happiness. And we have for too long tried to present truth as if that's going to be the thing that changes people's lives, when what we need to be providing is happiness. Because that's what people are looking for. Well, okay. A few things. I mean, what would you say to that approach? If somebody first says people are not in a search for truth, they're in a search for happiness, would you agree or disagree? Absolutely, we would agree. So what do we do with that information? Yeah, so first of all, what we do is we help them find where real happiness is through the truth. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. All right? And so Christ says that I have come that you may have life and that you may have it more abundantly. And so, yes, there is happiness, but you have to see what that happens. You have to have it defined for you. Because the problem is, people are in pursuit of happiness, but they don't know what it looks like. What these guys are doing is giving them the shortcut that the world out there has to offer. And really, ultimately, let me just say, that's what's happening is, people are redefining the church as the world with a happy face. Right? It's the world with a little bit lighter tone, a little bit of religion sprinkled over it, so that it's a little bit better than what's going on out there, but not much. All right, so it's kind of, they just incorporated the world into what we're doing. And we'll talk more about that, in fact, as we talk about the emerging church. There's a little bit of that there too, but that's got a little bit of a distinction to it. So what they're saying is that we need to give people happiness on their terms in the way that they define it. Well, ultimately, what is that going to lead to? I mean, if you give people the thing that they're asking for, happiness, I mean, what has that already led to for people? All right, and therefore, where's somebody going to be left? Personally. If they're looking for something more, and you give them exactly what they're looking for, it's not enough, all right? They're going to end up feeling the same way that they did at the start of this whole process, and that's what's happening. It's a tremendously high turnover rate. So you got people coming in and you get them excited, and then that wanes and they go out. But the idea is just to keep the flow. Okay. Keep people coming in. There's no consistency. There's no discipleship. There's no transformation actually happening. What you just have is just a constant in and out, which again is more like a business model. You know, I don't necessarily need to keep the same customers. I just need to make sure I've got customer flow. As long as I got people I'm continuing to appeal to, I can have that turnaround so long as I got people coming back. It kind of makes the people disposable. And as long as at any given moment we've got the numbers that we want in the seats. So it ends up leading to emptiness. Along with this, in order to provide for this sort of happiness, what ends up happening is people, to address these felt needs, we have programs. You ever drive by the churches these days and see on the billboards all the programs that they have? We have a grief program. Well, that sounds pretty good. We need to deal with grief, don't we? And then we have a divorcee program. All right. And then we have the widows or retired ministry. And then we have, and let's get a little bit more specific, we have the single moms ministry, and we have the teen ministry, and then we have the businessman's ministry, and then we get more and more detailed and section people off, and basically we give you what you're looking for. These programs that are suggested in all these different areas and that so many churches have kind of taken on and sectioned themselves off, how does that compare to the New Testament pattern? No, it doesn't. But they did have a widow's program, didn't they? Didn't Paul talk about the widow's ministry? Pardon?
Took care of themselves.
Yeah. If there's a need, they took care of it. Absolutely. But let me just say this. Do you see any sectioning off of the message? Do you see any sectioning off of the gospel in order to address this group or this group? I'll tell you the place where I think this has most influenced us is the youth ministry. Now, we don't have a youth ministry per se, and most churches, certainly conservative churches that we know of, don't have youth ministries. And yet, in various ways, they section off the youth to teach them something different than what everybody else is learning. And they end up making a different church for them. Some people in the denominations call it children's church and things like that. There are actually pastors in the denominations who are fighting back against this because those children are not being brought up. They're not learning the same gospel as everybody else. They're ultimately learning something that's very watered down. And by the time they get to adulthood, all they've ever known is children's church, and they go out into the world and they've lost their faith because it has no foundations. There's no building blocks of it and so forth. And I think we need to be very careful in addressing issues with children in terms that suggest that the Bible has something different to say to them than everybody else, because the gospel is the same. It is the same for the young man. It is the same for the old man. It is the same for the woman or the man. It is the same for the married and for the unmarried. Now, does the gospel have something specifically say to married people? Yes. Does it have specific warnings for young people? Yes. And so I'm not saying that there's nothing pictured there at all. But if we wholly set things over here, and there's just a real danger in bringing up children on teen issue workbooks. And so it's like, you know, we're gonna talk to you like you're the only ones dealing with these things, and we're gonna section you off and act like the Bible has this only to say to you, when really these are issues that they need to understand we all deal with. And the Bible addresses us all in the same terms. I think my granddad did a talk at the leadership camp, the young men's leadership camp, a few years ago, and he talked about Ecclesiastes chapter 11, where it does tell young people to enjoy your youth. And yet, for all these things, you'll be brought into judgment. There was a man who took issue with that. It was such a downer. It's the truth. And we need to be, you know, we need to be propping these young people up, and we need to be encouraging them. And this was just such a sobering thing. And I'm like, sobriety is what young people need most these days. And so to take him to task for telling them exactly what Solomon has written by the inspiration of God, I was appalled. I was appalled at the notion that would garner any sort of pushback from a man who claims to be a teacher of the gospel. And so so we need to be careful that we don't overdo that. I realize that we have to teach children's classrooms, and we have to teach things that are appropriate to the age level and so forth. And yet all the while, we need to be bringing them along into the full knowledge of the truth and of the gospel. Yes, sir. Right. There is no preparation for the real world across the board, much less in churches. And so that's absolutely, it's to make everybody feel good about themselves. This kind of goes in with the next question. The focus of the assemblies is what they call seeker friendly. You may or may not have heard that term, but again, this is a very common term. It's the idea that whatever we do when we're here, our Bible classes, our worship service, everything needs to be focused on the person who may or may not walk in off the street. And our worship needs to be focused on bringing them in. And really, it's an evangelistic effort is what we're doing when we come together to worship. Again, how does this compare with the New Testament? All right. So in 1 Corinthians 14, I think the idea is make your worship so that it can be understood by whoever is there. It is not make your worship so that it is focused on whoever comes in, but rather so that it is understood by whoever comes in so that we can worship together. Paul? Sure. And so what we find is that evangelism can be a byproduct of worship, but it is not what worship is. As Tony just said, worship is focused towards God. That is where our worship needs to be focused. And as we open up the New Testament, and as we see what God has to say, just 1 Corinthians is a good example. All the instruction that Paul gives. 1 Corinthians, if they follow everything Paul says, is not going to be a very seeker-friendly church. They're going to offend a lot of people by doing just what Paul says. All right? And so we have to be careful that we do not end up saying, let's think in terms of converting the person who's walking in the door. Now, if our whole focus is on converting somebody who doesn't know the gospel, who's never, is not familiar with the Bible, and that's where all of our worship is focused, what happens to the church? It doesn't grow. It can't. It can't, because all we're focused on is introduction of the Bible. And we have to stay there. Right. Yeah, it does grow numerically, sure. And in fact, it does grow, but with constant schisms and divisions and departures and so forth, because people start to grow and they say, wait a minute, what are we doing here? So it does create problems. But that focus on the external. Now, again, it's one thing to say, listen, we're going to have a gospel meeting in which we're going to preach things that would be helpful to babes or people who are not believers and so forth. And so we might make those appeals. And yet even there, I think we need to make sure that we are preaching something that is helpful and effective to the whole group. In other words, our message never needs to be past and not helpful to the people here. If it's not helpful to the people here, then we need to do it somewhere else. We need to preach that or teach that somewhere else. And so this needs to be, our worship needs to be something that is both helpful and helping us grow, but also, of course, that is pleasing and worshipful to God. What has happened as a result of this focus on the externals is people have said, people, if they come in, they're going to feel uncomfortable with our hymns. Because they're full of theology, and the tunes are not contemporary and modern, and so again, even in the denominational world, this has become quite the complaint that what has risen to the top is songs that either mimic what the world is doing. So you have these sort of rock ballad songs, love songs to God. They mimic that. Or they just use it entirely. There's one of these mega churches that recently, as they're passing the collection plate around, played Pink Floyd's Money. I kid you not. And that's the song that they played to, appeal to people to get them to empty their pockets. And so they will find something that they can maybe massage and get some religious, I don't even know how you get a religious message out of that song, but massage and get some religious message from it and bring that into the worship service. And what people are doing is going, this is cool. I mean, I thought church was going to be all kind of stuffy and everything. This is really cool. I mean, I could get into this. And what they're doing is they're coming to a concert. They're coming to an event. People are appealing on those terms. But not only are they making the music more contemporary, they're also dumbing the music down till it says nothing at all. And they call a lot of these songs 7-11 songs. You may have heard that phrase referring to songs. It's seven words repeated 11 times. And that's the song. And it's something that everybody can just repeat and wave their arms in the air and learn nothing. And so again, that's focused on the external, focus on people. And not focused on God, not focused on learning anything as we're instructed in Ephesians 5 and verse 19. And so in so many ways, they're making themselves really just a social, psychological experiment, which of course works out if you are charismatic enough. Now this brings me to the next point. You've got to have a charismatic leader in these groups. Every mega church has a mega pastor. And it is focused on him primarily. Not only does Rick Warren have his Saddleback Church out there, but others who want to follow after, he encourages them to buy his program, the 40 Days of Purpose or something like that. I think that's the name of it. What you have to do, you have to get his videos and you play them for the group. And you have to buy into it totally. All right? You have to give him control of all of your worship services for 40 days. And he promised you, if you'll follow, then you'll grow. But you've got to do exactly what he says. And so what's happened is, for the most part, the people who have bought into this, and it's tens of thousands of churches from all different denominations, they've bought into this, and they do grow, but then once they get past that initial point of energy, they don't have the front man to maintain the energy, and they flatten out and start losing members, and then those members go find a place where there is that personality. So he says, if you don't do it this way, if you don't look, you know, don't watch the DVDs and then you try to present this yourself, it's me. God has revealed this to me, and you got to let me deliver all of this. So use these DVDs. How does that stack up to the way that, you know, Paul talks about the preaching of the gospel? Yeah, it's not about me. It's not about who gets credit. In fact, I'm glad in some instances I don't get credit for this, because it's not about that. Tom Holley, I love what he says when he's teaching people. He says, my goal is to teach people in such a way that they need me less. I want to teach people to study the Bible and to know it on their own, and then to teach others. I don't want them to come to me and constantly be coming back to me, and me be the central focus of their relationship to God. That should not be. Preachers should be preaching themselves out of a job in some sense, at least in the sense of needing that person to guide you personally in your relationship to God. And so this is diametrically opposed to the attitudes that we see from faithful gospel preachers in the New Testament. What are the consequences that come with focusing on the numbers? We've talked about it a little bit, but just focusing a little bit more on that. And it's some things I want to point out about these. Right. Here's what Rick Warren says. Whatever is working, by working he means bringing in the people, is obviously blessed by God. And we should criticize nothing that God has blessed. And whatever is not working needs to be tossed to the side. Well, by his standards, the truth rarely works. And so often, almost always, gets tossed to the side. When the truth does not appeal, when the truth does not bring people in, the truth gets tossed to the side. And so when you focus on numbers, numbers become metric. Numbers becomes the thing by which you say, this is working or this is not working. And of course, what's the problem with that from the New Testament perspective? Where are the numbers?
Few will be saved.
All right, we got few will be saved. So we got a statement saying the numbers are not going to be with us. What else?
Change the message.
That's right. In fact, he never does. Anytime people say, well, that's really hard, Jesus doesn't go, oh, wait. Let me massage that a little bit. No. In fact, most of the time he doubles down and he says, that's exactly what I'm saying. And so we never see that. We do see the multitudes departing. Ultimately, the numbers are on the side of crucifying Jesus. That's where the numbers are. The numbers are on the side of persecution and rejection. The numbers, ultimately, on the whole, are never with the acceptance. We may have this outlier here in Acts chapter 2, but the numbers. So if we point to that, truth is always going to suffer as a result. So the message that that is preached, I can't remember the guy's name. I wish I could remember his name, but he had the Hour of Power television show, had a Crystal Palace. I can't remember his name, but he was on television many years ago. And it's the guy that Rick Warren has sort of patterned himself after, as well as some of these other megachurch guys. And what he said is, one of the greatest disservices we have done to people is to harp on their sin and their lost relationship with God in order to try to get them into a saved relationship with God. He said, you know, we've destroyed their self-esteem, and all of these things. So he just jettisoned that from his message. His message was, you are special, you are wonderful, and God wants you to be a part of His family. And he's over there just begging you. And because of how wonderful and special you are. Rick Warren put it this way. He had an opportunity to teach at a TED Talk. You may or may not know what that's like, where they get all these great speakers to come and deliver on their areas of expertise. And so what he said is that God created you, and so His favorite thing is to see you be you. You know, isn't that what you want from your children, is for them to just act like them, their special little selves? And so when God sees you acting like your personality, then He says, that's My boy, or that's My girl. That's His exact words. That's My boy, or that's My girl. And He likes nothing better than that. Well, I'll be honest, I certainly do like my children's personalities, for the most part. But there's a lot of that that Proverbs tells me I've got to drive out, and I really don't need Proverbs to even give me the motivation for it. I mean, it's good to have that instruction, but I didn't need Proverbs to tell me there are certain things you're not going to like that your children do, and you're going to want to do something about that. And so here is somebody saying, God has no desire to change you. God has no desire to get in the way of your happiness and your desires. He wants you to be you, and He just wants to have a relationship. And whatever you've done, He is just waiting to forgive you. You just come to Him. And then, of course, at the end of His book, here's the little prayer that you say, I accept you. And then He says, welcome to the family of God. And so there's no mention in any of His books, not the purpose-driven life, not the purpose-driven church. He doesn't want to talk about the deity of Christ, because, incidentally, He says, we can accept Mormons into fellowship. We can accept Catholics into fellowship. There's no problem with us bringing this movement to all these various denominations. And so there's nothing of the deity of Christ. There's nothing of the resurrection of Christ. He doesn't mention the resurrection of Christ one time in his section on what the gospel message is. And in fact, as far as the cross, his only mentions of it are, this is how much Jesus loves you. No mention of why He had to die. Certainly no mention of your sin. Zero. And so here's a message. Because the numbers is the focus, then the truth must ultimately suffer. You just can't have that there. The truth is offensive. Is it not? Is it a stumbling block? It is foolishness. Matt? No, it more than any other movement throws doctrine completely by the wayside. More so than non-denominational churches. Non-denominational churches, you'll usually find a considerable influence of one denomination or another still there. This, it's gone. You can read a whole Joel Osteen book and find nothing that mirrors anything from the scriptures. I mean, it's devoid of anything other than you're here to be successful. And that ultimately is the metric of whether or not you have a good relationship with God. Are you doing well financially? Because that's what proves whether or not you're doing right. This ties in very well with the health and wealth gospel that is presented by so many. Ultimately, what it does is it tells people you need to find a church that's providing you with the best services. And of course, this has been around for many, many years, and it's been growing. It's just kind of really culminated in a large degree in some of the modern iterations of it, with Rick Warren and so forth, and people have taken it and run with it. But many years ago, Hiram Hutto said he got a call from somebody and said, does your church provide daycare services? And he said, no, ma'am, we are a church. And does your church provide meal services? No, ma'am, we are a church. Well, do you have any sort of school programs and after school programs, any sort of athletic programs? No, ma'am, we are a church. And that's just kept being his answers. We are a church. But church has been so redefined. till people don't understand that response any longer. And it never did get through to her. He said no matter how many times he said it, she just kept right on asking and finally said, well, I'm gonna have to find another church. Yes, I believe you will. You know, because she was looking for something other than what the New Testament provided. What is the nature of our relationship to the church in the New Testament compared to this attitude of what kind of services do you offer? What does Paul say about our relationship to the church that and the way it contrasts with that? Right. Yeah, Paul speaks in terms of what you bring to the church, not what services you get from the church. All right. He speaks in terms of you coming and you participating. And even in terms of if there's an allusion, like in Hebrews chapter 10, where it talks about the assembly and building one another up in love. And so there's an allusion of you would get that from coming to the assemblies. And yet it is put in terms of you giving it. And so certainly you would want to get that from coming to an assembly. But the Hebrew writer doesn't say come so that you can get this. He says come so that you can give this. And so our participation and our relationship to the church is almost always spoken of in terms of you come and you bring this and you give this to the church, not you get this from the church. And so our relationship needs to be one of giving. That is not the model here. And of course, that's, again, one of the reasons that it is so popular. I'll just say this, and I know we're out of time. What we want to be very careful of doing is looking at this literature and thinking, well, let me see what good I can find from it. Because let me just say, from a corporate standpoint, it's all true. It is all true, and yes, it all works. And so you got to be very careful, because what you're doing when you say, let me see what good, you have entered into a discussion with somebody who has a very different goal from you. And so as one friend said, he said, I realized at some moment I was taking advice from a heretic, you know, because he was just reading and seeing what he could gain from it. And he kept making compromises. He'd go, I think we could do that. And he just shut it and put it down and said, no, thanks. That's not where we get our advice about church growth or anything else. And so we want to be careful that we don't get enamored with the numbers and so forth and try to make compromises. Eric will take the class Wednesday. Next Sunday, we will talk about the emergent church, the emerging or emergent church. And it's got some similarities to the megachurch, but also some distinctions, and we'll talk about those. Appreciate everybody's good attention.